We're not simply here talking about a straightforward message, although that certainly appears in the book of Ezekiel. We're talking about justifying that message with a particular kind of ecstatic experience. And the question that emerges, and which I was trying to work at in my article, is what's the reference value of that ecstatic experience? If I were standing in the temple in 592 or whenever, when Ezekiel was giving his prophecy in Babylon, would I have seen the same things going on that the prophet claimed to have seen? And my answer, at least with regard to mourning for Tammuz in chapter 8, verse 14, is no, I would not have seen that.
Welcome to It Means What It Means, the podcast in which a guy with some college and a day job has long-form conversations about biblical texts. In keeping with my goal, as of late, to do a better job of promoting myself and allowing you avenues to communicate with me, I'd like to remind you, please reach out to me at itmeanswhatitmeans@gmail.com with feedback or guest suggestions, or maybe you have something that you want me to check out that you have written or someone has written, or a lecture or YouTube video, whatever. itmeanswhatitmeans@gmail.com. Today's guest is William S. Morrow, and we'll be discussing a passage from the book of Ezekiel. And I have to say, at the end of this episode, he probably does the best job of anyone so far in the 40-something, 42 interviews that I've done thus far. I think he might do the best job of providing recommendations at the end. So those will be in the show notes. And this is the first of, I think, 5 of the next 6 episodes will be about Hebrew Bible. And I'm pretty excited about that because I do not want to camp out too much in New Testament, because even for the Protestant Bible, that is the minority. There is more material that is there to be covered and more material that should be covered in Hebrew Bible. And I do not want to sell that short, because New Testament really only applies to Christians, but there's a whole lot more coverage that I get from people who may want to listen to this podcast. So I don't want anyone to feel alienated or think that they have to skip an episode. So without any more yakking from me, here's my conversation with William S. Morrow. William S. Morrow, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jared. It's good to be here.
Can we start out with you telling the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm now emeritus professor of the School of Religion of Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. I was originally appointed as the professor of Hebrew and Hebrew scriptures at Queen's Theological College, which was affiliated with Queen's University up until 2015. I spent most of my academic life teaching and writing about the Hebrew scriptures and ancient Near Eastern literature.
Okay, thank you. So the specific topic of our conversation today is going to be your article in the Journal of Biblical Literature, Mourning for Tammuz, or Tammuz, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, Prophecy and Projection in Ezekiel 8:14. So my first question, it's a thesis statement in your article. You say, my primary purpose in this article is to argue that the majority opinion cannot be correct. So what is that majority opinion?
Sure. So let's just back up for a moment here. What's the problem in reading Ezekiel chapter 8? It's not simply confined to Ezekiel chapter 8. What we're talking about is how to interpret visionary literature as we find it in prophetic books. Often in prophetic books, you'll find accounts, dramatic accounts of encounters with God, or say visions of the historical process. One thinks, for example, here, not only of Ezekiel, of course, we have the famous encounter between Ezekiel and Yahweh, the God of Israel, with the four creatures and the rolling wheels in chapter 1. And we have visions of the movement of God to and from the temple in chapters 11, and again in the description of the new temple later on in chapter 43. But also you have visionary statements in or descriptions in books like Zechariah or Daniel, or for that matter, in the New Testament, we could think of the book of Revelation. And the question is always, I think, what is the referent value of this kind of visionary literature? Would we see what the prophet saw? And what is the prophet trying to tell us as readers, as listeners, by using this dramatic, visionary, and sometimes fantastic language? Now, for the most part, when people have read Ezekiel chapter 8, that is the majority of scholars, and you can check this up by looking at various commentaries and special articles, most people have taken Ezekiel chapter 8, verse 14, more or less at face value. The prophet, although he is apparently situated in Babylon among the exiles, around 592 BCE, so around 5 years after the first exile. Did I say 592? I meant a little later than that. But anyway, he tells his listeners that he has seen in the temple a group of women mourning for a god called Tammuz. And my article was mainly interested in challenging the idea that this has a literal historical referent value. I wanted to look at what it meant to mourn a god like Tammuz or Tammuz in the ancient world and ask if the conditions for that stacked up with what the prophet claimed to be seeing as a set of visions of abominable, what he calls abominable practices in the first temple at that time period. And if you recall the way the chapter unfolds, what do you have? You have, first of all, the vision of some kind of unacceptable cult object in a gate shrine. Then as the prophet moves towards the temple from the outside to the inn, he has to dig through a wall to see a group of elders worshiping some kind of fantastic creatures who are painted or pictured on the walls of a secret shrine. Then he comes to the vision of the women wailing for Tammuz. And finally, he will see a group of men with their backs to the altar in the court of sacrifice worshiping the sun. There's a few fantastic elements that may be implicit in this visionary survey of what the prophet thinks of as unacceptable cult practices. But the one that I was interested in was women mourning for the god Tammuz.
So is that figure of Tammuz someone that would have been recognized in the ancient world by people reading or hearing this text?
Yes, this brings us into a very interesting chapter in ancient Near Eastern literature and in ancient Near Eastern religion, the idea that the agricultural year was marked by mourning rituals which were took place when the agricultural crops were starting to dry or disappear because of a significant change in seasons. This is a Near Eastern deity who was thought to be the consort of the goddess Ishtar. And his mythology actually reaches far back into Sumerian times, well into the third millennium before the Common Era. And what it appears is that among the various rites that were associated with this god, at the end of the agricultural year, and remember in Mesopotamia, you're dealing with a irrigation culture. So probably in mid-July, when the grain harvest had finished, this represented a kind of caesura or cease in the fertility of the ground, at least temporarily. And this is associated with the death of Tammuz, his descent to the underworld, and mourning by his consort goddess Ishtar. Now, you actually have a kind of similar cultic expression in the West Semitic world, but it's slightly different because there you have agricultural year, which is not marked by fertilization through irrigation, but it's dependent upon the rainfall. So the rain stops sometime in springtime. There's going to be a desiccation of the ground, and no more plants are going to be able to grow easily, especially with regard to the grain. And once again, you have the idea that the goddess has lost her consort, and this becomes a time to mark a shift in the agricultural year by various kinds of mourning rites.
So the long and short of it, though, is this is not something that should be happening in the temple.
All right, so let's talk about that. First of all, in both Mesopotamia and in the West Semitic world, and I'm thinking particularly of Phoenicia in this particular case, you have two different kinds of rites that are associated with mourning the loss of the god. Some of these are informal. They take place in streets. They take place in people's homes. They're widespread throughout the culture. And others are confined to state-sponsored temples. But when they appear in state-sponsored temples, the temples are dedicated to the worship of a goddess. The consort of the goddess is certainly in Mesopotamia considered to be less important than the goddess. But in any case, if this rite took place in the temple in Jerusalem, we would expect that temple would be one in which worship of the goddess was considered to be one of its primary and important functions. And that's not true of the Temple of Yahweh at the end of the first temple period.
So that's the abominable behavior that he's seeing here, is these women are mourning a god they should not be.
That's correct.
Okay. So then, yeah, and there's no historical reason or even literary reason beyond this passage to think that the temple in Jerusalem was ever used to worship this. Are there people who suggest that there were?
Now we're getting into a real hornet's nest, because what we're going to have to talk about is what is the possibility that some kind of goddess was associated with the worship of Yahweh in the first temple period in the world of ancient Israel. And this is a hot topic. It's one in which people have various kinds of opinions about. Approach of the biblical writers themselves is to suggest that Yahweh was not associated with a goddess, and that when Manasseh, for example, 2 Kings chapter 21, introduces the worship of Baal and Asherah to the temple, this is clearly an intrusion of a foreign element which doesn't belong to the true worship of Yahweh and of the origins of Israelite religion. Now, some people have called into question this construct of the biblical writers and suggested that at some point a goddess called Asherah might have been associated with Yahweh. I don't think the evidence is very strong for that. There is some evidence that there was a cult pole called an Asherah that somehow was at one point considered part and parcel of the temple paraphernalia, although what its relationship to the goddess who bore that name is quite debatable. More to the point, however, the absolutely no indication that Yahweh was ever considered to be a rising and dying god of the kind of grain deities that we've just been talking about from Phoenicia or in Mesopotamia. And so I think the idea that a goddess of this kind would have ever been venerated in the temple is really off the mark.
because I'm not an expert, I have to be careful asking a question like this, but there is a hypothesis about a similarity between Yahweh and a storm god like Baal, correct?
Correct.
Were storm gods ever the object of this kind of veneration, or was it solely agricultural deities?
I don't think we should make an opposition between a storm god and a agricultural deity. There are clear indications that the storm god was, in fact, involved in mythology that has to do with the change of seasons in the years. The primary example of this in Canaanite mythology would be the myth of Baal that was found in Ugarit. One of Baal's, Baal Hadad's, Baal's an honorific, it means simply the Lord. He was actually called Hadad. One of his adventures is confrontation with the god Mot, or the god Death, if you will. And in that adventure, he's temporarily bested by the god and has to be rescued by his sister consort, Anat. And most people would see behind that myth a kind of story of the agricultural year. As the rain god, as the storm god, Baal is powerful for about half the year, from when the rain starts, say in late September, all the way through to the end of April. But then the dry season comes, the hot season comes, and as it were, he temporarily dies. And it's thought that mythology is also reflected in later Phoenician cults, most notably the one centered on Byblos, which is where I drew some of my own ethnographic comparisons from. So yes, so Yahweh was equated with Baal. You find a number of attributions of thunder god imagery to Yahweh, perhaps most notably in Psalm chapter 29. But I don't think that all of the aspects of Baal were transferred onto Yahweh. The storm god imagery was, but not the death of the god as the agricultural year changed.
Is there any significance in the concentration of Yahwistic worship in the temple as opposed to how it had been previous? And I know that's not the subject of this article, so if that's not a road you want to go down, that's fine.
Oh, let's go down it, but can you clarify Please. Your question? I didn't really quite understand it.
So prior to the temple, there was still Yahweh worship, correct?
So let's be clear about our reference points here. You're talking about prior to the Solomonic Temple, which is probably dedicated around 965 or something like this.
Yes.
Prior to the temple in Jerusalem, Yahweh probably had a cult place, for example, at Shiloh. And the book of Joshua also indicates some worship activity in Shechem, for example. Yeah, there are a number of cult places that Yahweh was associated with prior to the Jerusalem temple.
So I guess if things were more diffuse before the temple, was there a temple ideology within that style of worship that was maybe always looking to edge out? I guess I'm trying to find like an underlying thread for a prophetic vision like this.
Right. So let's grasp the nettle. What we're talking about here in a roundabout way are the origins of monotheism in ancient Israel. Should we consider monotheism in ancient Israel to be a fairly late development in the development of its religion? There certainly are scholars who believe that. I am not one of them. I tend to think that there was a pretty firm kind of monotheism in which Yahweh was regarded not as the only deity, but as the one Israel exclusively had to relate to fairly far back in Israel's history. It's already reflected, for example, in the prophecies of Amos and Hosea, and I don't think that Amos and Hosea are innovating in this particular case. They are reflecting what is regarded as a well-known tradition. To me, the prophetic belief system with its insistence on Yahweh alone, if you want to use that kind of vocabulary, was deeply rooted in the consciousness of Israel from early times and did not depend upon the erection of the temple in Jerusalem.
Okay. And I guess in this context then, where, so Ezekiel is observing the mourning for Tammuz as an abominable act.
Right.
Do we think, I guess, is the term monolatry, is he saying these are people mourning for a God that exists, or just people doing a thing, or do we not know from the text?
I don't know whether Ezekiel thinks that Yahweh is the only God who exists or not.
Okay.
I think you used a term which requires some degree of unpacking, because you talked about monolatry. So let's be clear about that. Monolatry is the worship of a single deity. It does not necessarily indicate that people who espouse that worship necessarily don't believe in the existence of other gods, simply don't believe that they're applicable to the needs and religious loyalties of Israel. Ezekiel is at least monolatrous. Is he a full-fledged monotheist? That's a tough question to answer. I don't think, in terms of the literature of the Hebrew Bible, that we have a full, clear statement of monotheism before the time of the second Isaiah, i.e. the prophet responsible for Isaiah chapters 40 to 55. I don't know what Ezekiel thought in that case.
So is it safe to say then, interpreting this passage does not necessarily mean that you have to plant your flag in any one of those different areas, either straight monotheism or monolatry or any of that?
No, I think that Ezekiel, I think, is the least interested in monolatry. So I'm going to plant my flag there, if nowhere else, just to use that metaphor.
Okay.
He is quite convinced that Israel ought to be solely devoted to Yahweh, and he is offended by what he perceives to be widespread worship of other deities in the Israelite context, and he believes that this form of apostasy is going to lead to imminent judgment of the nation.
Yeah, in a sense, like the chapter's ending, and I'm not listening. They've done this, they're going to be judged.
So when you read chapter 8, you have to realize that it's only the opening salvo of a literary unit that runs from chapter 8 through to chapter 11. Chapter 8 is the basis for a scene of judgment, which takes place in chapter 9, and which will eventually lead in the prophet's vision to perceiving that the Spirit of Yahweh has abandoned the temple. Of course, that's important information, because in the ancient world, one assumes that the only way that a god's temple could be destroyed is if that the god had already abandoned it. So Yahweh is going to abandon the temple at the end of chapter 11. He will return to it in chapter 43 when the new temple is being built. But in the meantime, that leaves the city of Jerusalem and the remnant of people left in Judah open to his judgment for their apostasy.
So they're just vulnerable without Yahweh. I had some thoughts there on the Ezekiel-specific stuff, but you mentioned imagery. So I want to jump back to talking about prophetic literature and visions in general. So there are prophets who are told to say things, right?
Correct.
And there are prophets who are shown things.
Right.
So I know apocalyptic literature, because you mentioned Revelation, is largely imagery, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any overlap here? I've never heard anybody describe Ezekiel as apocalyptic literature. First question, is it?
All right. First of all, you will find writers who think of Ezekiel as proto-apocalyptic. That is, as using a rhetoric and a visionary kind of trope which anticipates the emergence of apocalyptic literature as we find it, say, in Daniel and, of course, in other late books from the Second Temple period. The question about whether it is apocalyptic or not depends upon how you want to define apocalyptic. Now, the way I understand apocalyptic usually deals with the end of history, and it usually suggests that secrets which are unknown to the general population have been revealed to a certain kind of visionary person who is often connected with a venerable person from Israel's past. You could stretch it and say that some of those features may be present in the book of Ezekiel, but I think Ezekiel doesn't see the judgment of Jerusalem as the end of history. I think he doesn't regard his overall message as a secret. On the contrary, it's something that ought to be obvious to the people he's talking to. And I don't think that Ezekiel is wrapping himself up with the status or the prestige of someone from the ancient past. I don't actually see that talking about Ezekiel as apocalyptic works. Now, where the overlap is with something that I said right at the beginning, however, what is the referent value of visionary literature? What is the referent value of prophetic visions? We're not simply here talking about a straightforward message, although that certainly appears in the book of Ezekiel. We're talking about justifying that message with a particular kind of ecstatic experience. And the question that emerges, and which I was trying to work at in my article, is what's the reference value of that ecstatic experience? If I were standing in the temple in 592 or whenever, when Ezekiel was giving his prophecy in Babylon, would I have seen the same things going on that the prophet claimed to have seen? And my answer, at least with regard to mourning for Tammuz in chapter 8, verse 14, is no, I would not have seen that.
So this is something specifically given to this prophet,
you know, to speak. What the prophet is doing is suggesting that all of Judah's un-Yahwistic behavior, if we can use that word, or idolatrous behavior, or apostate abominable behavior, or abominable behavior, wherever it took place, has effectively compromised the temple to the point that Yahweh can no longer stand living there. That's what I think's going on.
So that, and again, I'll be careful because I'm not above correction, obviously. That kind of sounds like a Deuteronomistic thing, right? Like if you do this, you'll live long in the land that you're being given. So the way that you've lived in the land has defiled it. You've defiled the temple. You're subject to judgment.
Oh, I think that's right, quite on. And most scholars would think that Ezekiel is not only informed by priestly thinking of a kind that you can find in the Holiness Code, i.e. Leviticus chapters 17 through 26, he's also informed by thinking which comes from the book of Deuteronomy. And in fact, in my article, I point out several sorts of differences between vocabulary or word usage that you can find in chapter 8 and Deuteronomy, especially Deuteronomy chapter 4. And yes, what you have there is a very clear covenantal theology in which possession of the land is predicated on exclusive veneration of the God Yahweh.
And you do mention at one point in the article that while Yahweh has abandoned the temple, Yahweh is still with the people. That does seem to add a layer of complexity to what the Deuteronomic equation is pretty arithmetic, and this seems to add some complexity there.
Yeah, that's right. So that's a good point. And so you have to remember that there, at this point in time, there are two populations. There is a population that has been exiled, what we call the first exile, which took place around 597. Many of the elite including a large part of the royal court, many priests associated with and skilled craftspeople were deported in 597 as punishment for an abortive rebellion that took place at that time. And so these people are settled in the land of Babylon. And in fact, in recent times, we have found archives which document some of the transactions that took place at this point. They were settled, for example, in a place called Al-Yahudiya or Judah City, somewhere in the middle of Babylon. And so question that arises is, what is the legitimacy of this population that's in exile versus this population that has been left in the land of Judah? And what you have here, and this is a complexity, a curve that you wouldn't find in Deuteronomic literature, is that it is the people in exile who are actually the true representatives of Judah. They are the people for whom God's promises remain alive. And so you have a kind of double rhetoric technique going on here with respect to Ezekiel chapter 8, because at the same time, you have a delegitimization of the people in Judah who are living, still living around the temple. The other hand of that is to affirm that the people who are in exile are the ones who have a future as the people of God.
So I guess that kind of carries the idea that they remain faithful and Yahweh remains faithful to them, and the covenant is not broken. The people who deserve the blame are going to receive it, and they're going to return and have the temple again.
That's correct.
Okay.
And that's up a dynamic which gets itself worked out eventually in books of Ezekiel, rather of Ezra and Nehemiah.
This may go outside of your expertise, but we know that there were still Jews spread around in a diaspora long after this point. Do they continue to identify that way, or how does that work?
Okay, so the result of the invasion of Judah by the Neo-Babylonians is basically to create two diaspora communities, as well as the community that remained. So one diaspora community is in Babylon, and the other diaspora community is in Egypt. And this is really the origins of both of those. Although we can imagine that there were probably people related to Judeans, if you like, or Judahites were living elsewhere, but it's in Egypt and Babylon that you get a sort of center of gravity. And the question is, what will be their allegiances to the, not simply the religion of the Second Temple period, but also to the political structures that are associated with it? In other words, who will be the legitimate representatives of Israel when it returns and reestablishes itself in the land of promise? And the fact of the matter is, it is the descendants of the elite in Babylon who insist that they are the legitimate representatives of the people, and they are the ones who have the right to reestablish the community and also to administer it when they return. And that's part and parcel of the dynamics that are implicit in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah.
I hope I didn't take us too far afield. With regard to the, like, your thesis, is the literal interpretation the historical interpretation? Is that historically how people have read this passage, or is it a fairly recent development?
No, I think that whenever we read the biblical record, our tendency is to want to take it at face value, unless we are somehow obliged not to. It stands to reason that many commentators through time have simply assumed that when Ezekiel said there were women mourning for Tammuz in the temple, that must have actually been the way it was. It's my approach and the approach of other people like me that is probably novel in this particular case.
Okay. So toward the end of the article, you mention that there are reconstructions that ought to be the subject of further research in this area. Is that something you've started working on, or are there other people who are working on that? And what might some of those be?
The article only came out at the beginning of 2023. So I don't think that's been enough time in the scholarly community to see any substantial reaction to it. In terms of my own research, I came at this because it's part of a larger interest of mine, which is to look for parallels between various institutions or concepts that you find in the Hebrew Bible and ancient Near Eastern literature and practice. I'm actually going to leave other people to tease out whatever might be the implications of my article for more work on Ezekiel chapter 8. I did notice that there's a very interesting paper coming up at the next annual meeting of the Society of Biblical Literature, which wants to compare Ezekiel chapter 8 to techniques that one can find in current cinematography. I'll be very interested to hear that paper. But myself, I've moved on to think about other parallels between ancient Near Eastern literature and the Bible that I find interesting. In fact, this particular paper actually grew out of a course in which I was looking at the relationship between sacrificial practice in ancient Israel and the relationship and sacrificial practices in ancient Greece. Now, you might think that that would be a stretch, but there actually are some fascinating overlaps as well as quite telling differences. I'm continuing to pursue my interest in ancient Near Eastern parallels to biblical literature and ritual, but I'm actually at the moment probably not going to do anything more with Ezekiel chapter 8.
Any idea where you do think you'll go? If you don't mind my asking.
Sure. I don't mind. I've spent a long time thinking about the relationship between covenantal texts and ancient Near Eastern treaty rituals. Most recently, I've turned to think about the so-called covenant of pieces in Genesis chapter 15, in which Yahweh, in the form of a torch, seems to pass through the pieces of a number of slaughtered animals. Commentators have noted some parallels to this practice in the past, but they haven't actually made a catalog of all of the possible parallels to this rite, which you can find both in ancient Greek sources and also in Hittite sources. And that's one of the things I intend to be working on at the moment.
Man, you guys look into some really cool stuff, because that sounds really exciting. And that paper that'll be at the annual meeting, now I know one paper I'll be going to watch because I'll be there in San Antonio next month.
Let's hope we can say hello to each other at some point.
Absolutely. So I like to leave plenty of time for this question because I'm hoping that I will start to get really long answers to this. And it's okay if you don't have a really long answer, but are there people, books, blogs, whatever, in that big sphere that consists of biblical studies that you would like to point people to?
I think first and foremost, some of the material that the Society of Biblical Literature itself has produced is worth looking at. Do you know or have you heard of Bible Odyssey, for example?
I've heard of it, yes.
Yeah. The Society of Biblical Literature has done a good job of curating various small articles and discussions on a number of topics and a number of topics in biblical studies. And I would recommend Bible Odyssey and other educational materials produced by the SBL to anyone who's interested in getting in more depth. Another really good resource, as far as I'm concerned, is the Library in Biblical Archaeological Review. Have you heard about this before?
Yes.
Their articles tend to be a bit popular, but they're usually very well researched and informative. And my opinion, it's always fun to go through their archives if you're looking for discussion on anything that has to do with biblical archaeology. That's a great resource. Now, another resource that's always worth using and which I recommended to my students constantly is the serial database that's curated by the American Theological Library Association called ATLA, Religion Periodicals. Some of your listeners may not be able to tap into that because it's usually a database that has to be subscribed to by a university library. But the ATLA resource is really good. Tends to be, although a little bit more on the technical side, but has an excellent scripture search button there. You can, through that, find a Bible verse or chapter. Find out, in a lot of cases, much of the scholarship that's been written on it. And if you're looking for a guide to technical literature, then that's an excellent resource as well. Another good resource, if you subscribe to or are a member of the Society of Biblical Literature, of course, is their collection of book reviews, the Review of Biblical Literature, which I think is also very useful. Yes, they tend to review monographs, though, and I would certainly go after that. In terms of cuneiform literature, I think that you can find some good things as well. And in particular, I want to make sure I get this, but you've heard of AWOL, the Ancient World Online?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think I have heard of that.
That's a fabulous resource, which will guide you to many different kinds of ancient studies of ancient literature from the Mesopotamian world, from the Egyptian world, and so on. It's an amazing resource and worth looking into. So that's, and I think it's still called that, still there. AWOL, the Ancient World Online, and it will give you bibliography and in many cases links to online books and articles in a large number of resources that are related to the study of ancient Israel, Mesopotamian world, the Egyptian world, and also ancient Greece and Persia.
I think those are all fantastic suggestions because they get at the heart of what I want. I feel like as ubiquitous as the Bible is, there are books, there are volumes on people's shelves, but it is appropriated by people for so many different reasons with so little qualification that it's infuriating to see how it's used when there are experts at probably every public university who know more than what people think they can have access to. So those are all really good resources, and I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I threw this curveball to somebody else, and I said I wouldn't do it anymore, but I'm going to do it anyway. What do you read for fun?
I read detective novels.
Okay.
First of all, a real big fan of Ian Rankin's Erebus series. I also read a fair amount of fantasy, science fiction type things. When I just want to kick back, that's the kind of material I'm likely to pick up.
Any examples you want to get? You don't have to. It's personal.
What have I read recently? I have to say that, I don't know, the latest Ian Rankin or novels would be the things I've picked up most recently.
Okay. But I will have those in the show notes just in case people are curious. There'll be links to that if people want to pick those up. Is there anything about the article that we didn't cover that you wanted to be brought up?
No, I think we've done pretty well. The only thing, yeah, we covered most of it. I think that if there's a piece of the article that we didn't talk about, it would be a question that it implicitly raises, which is where do women discover their agency within the ambit of monotheistic faith? One of the interesting things about this piece of research is that it uncovers something that we can't actually see in the Bible, which is women taking agency as ritual agents, worshiping the Queen of Heaven, according to Jeremiah chapter 44, mourning for Tammuz or mourning for the consort of the goddess, according to Ezekiel chapter 8. And whatever else we might think about these kinds of activities, they do represent women, mainly women, engaged in liturgical activities. And the question that emerges for me is if this is delegitimated from the point of view of the prophet, where do women discover their agency as worshipers and practitioners of religious activities within the ambit of Israelite faith? And think that there is an answer to that question, which emerges in Second Temple Judaism, which is to begin to transfer some of the important rites of ancient Jewish religion into the home. But it's always emerges there, I think, in any kind of feminist-oriented discourse to the study of the biblical tradition. Where are the women? What helps to legitimate them as full-fledged participants in the religion of ancient Israel? And if this particular kind of activity is regarded as unacceptable, what was and is?
That's a lot. That seems like that's more than one article though, right?
That's right.
Okay. Unless you have anything else, I think we'll call this one good.
All right then.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe and rate the podcast on your favorite platform. If you are interested in following, supporting, or engaging with the podcast anywhere else, check out the link tree that I've hyperlinked in the show notes. I try to put episodes out as soon as possible for $5 a month on Patreon. So if there's something that I've announced or you've seen on social media, just know $5 a month, you can listen to every episode that I have edited. Take care.